Hello, everyone. This is Bob Zeta. My amateur radio call sign is N1BLF, November 1, the Bravo Lima Foxtrot. We'll be reading today in digest form, World Radio Magazine, the month, March 2007. World Radio is published by Armand Noble, N6WR. Its headquarters is at 2120 28th Street, Sacramento, California, 95818. This recording is a production of the Courage Andy Hemp System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, 55422. It is for the use of eligible Andy Hemp members only. Any other use may violate copyright laws. Andy Hemp may be reached at area 763-520-0512 or the email address handyham@courage.org. The website www.handyham.org. We'll go with the editor's log first. The editor is Nancy Kott, K-O-T-T. Nancy's call is WZ8C. The elimination of the Morse code requirement has focused the eyes of the world on amateur radio. I didn't expect the FCC ruling to be of interest to the general public. Imagine my surprise when the New York Times ran a large feature story about Morse code. Time magazine covered it, too. This snowballed into dozens of articles written in local papers. The Weekly Reader, a newspaper for grade school children, even picked up the story. As a result, people are searching for information on the Internet. One of the top websites that come up in the search engines for ham radio is e-ham.com. Unfortunately, name-calling, insults, and vulgarity by both pro-requirement and anti-requirement points of view pepper the email postings, along with horrible grammar usage and misspellings. Hams come off looking illiterate, intolerant, gross, and rude. I got a call from The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, a cable pseudo-news show that satires current events. The researchers for the show read the comments on eHam and thought I would be, quoting, foaming at the mouth, close quote, to rant retaliations at those who had posted comments about me personally and against Morse code. They wanted me to go on The Daily Show and show that I thought the new people coming in were ignorant trash who would pollute our ham radio gene pool. That is the impression they got of the ham community from the Internet. I explained to them that I couldn't say what they wanted to hear because it wasn't true, and that the people who posted on eHam weren't a fair representation. I would, however, say that I was unhappy about the elimination of the requirement because it represented a lowering of technical standards. They asked if I knew anyone who would go on TV and say that sea beers will ruin ham radio. I gave them the names of some pro-code people who feel strongly about the requirement, but apparently they weren't willing to say that either because The Daily Show didn't call back. With the elimination of the Morse code requirements, perhaps it is a good time to review another code, the Amateur's Code. It is an important part of our foundation, and the new hams entering our community may not have read it. Paul M. Siegel, W9EEA, wrote the Amateur's Code in 1928. The radio amateur is considerate. Never knowingly operates in such a way as to lessen the pleasure of others. Loyal. Offers loyalty, encouragement, and support to other amateurs, local clubs, and the American Radio Relay League, through which amateur radio in the United States is represented nationally and internationally. Progressive, with knowledge abreast of science, a well-built and efficient station, an operation above reproach. Friendly, slow and patient operating when requested, friendly advice and counsel to the beginner, kindly assistance, cooperation, and consideration for the interests of others. These are the hallmarks of the amateur spirit. Balanced. Radio is an avocation, never interfering with duties owed to family, job, school, or community. Patriotic. Station and skill always ready for service to country and community. I hope you will think twice before permanently posting mean-spirited comments on the Internet, where anyone who is researching amateur radio can read them. Is it the impression that people will glean from your comments, the impression that you are intending to project? The world is watching. Let's clean up our act. Please keep in touch either through our web page at www.wr6wr.com or email directly to me at nancy@tir.com or postal mail directly to Nancy, WZHC, P.O. Box 807, Hadley, H-A-D-L-E-Y, Michigan, M-I, 48440. Let's move right along now to our first featured piece. It's titled Amateur Radio Aids Mount Everest Climbers. The author is Ray Gasick, G-A-S-C-H-K, W-7-F-Y-A. Climb leader Sean Disney from South Africa asked his friend, technical expert, and fellow climber Mike Hodges from San Francisco, California, to help provide communications assistance for a climb of Mount Everest. Mike has many years of experience hang gliding and mountain climbing. Yes, Mark Novell, WI7YN, manager of the Oakland, California HRO store, for his recommendation for a small portable antenna for use on 2 meters. Mark suggested a 5-element antenna, the ALK-2M Slant-440L5, which Mike bought. ALK Antennas is in Walnut Creek, California, and makes log periodic antennas for VHF, UHF, amateur radio use. The website is www.elkantennas.com. Sean Disney on conditions. Mount Everest is perhaps the harshest environment on the planet for humans and their climbing gear, as well as for their communications equipment. Laptops, satellite phones, and two-way radios are put through incredible daily temperature extremes, amazing storms, and the abuse that comes with being dragged up and down the icy and rocky terrain of the world's highest mountain. The season just completed on Mount Everest proved to be the most deadly in the last decade. At least 10 deaths were attributed to the extreme conditions encountered this past May on the mountain. However, expedition leader Sean Disney and his team from South Africa were unsuccessful at reaching the summit and returned home with all fingers and toes intact. Their communications gear stood strong through the worst storms this season had to offer, while other teams struggled to maintain communications between base camp and the higher camps. The Khumbu icefall above base camp is perhaps one of the most treacherous crossings, with house-sized blocks of ice shifting daily in the afternoon sun. The ridges separating base camp, the icefall, and upper camps also cause problems with communications. Communications between camps 1 through 4 were rather straightforward with the Yaesu VX-170 handhelds the team brought along. Making the hop from base camp to the upper camps and the summit is made a bit more complicated by some rather vertical terrain. Sean Disney reported after the expedition that, quoting, "Our communications gear is one of the best assets for team safety on the mountain, thanks to Mark Novell, W7YN, of the HRO Oakland store for suggesting the ALK antenna." Sean counted on the ALK antennas to assure contact between all members of the team. The true portability, lightweight, and ease of assembly contributed to the success of the team. The next featured piece, New Mexico's Youngest Ham. Author, Ralph Clark, NM5RC. 7-year-old Cub Scout Justin Eldridge earned his technician license in November to become, it is believed, the youngest ham in New Mexico. He followed up several months of tutoring by his father, KB5ENN, and mother, KC5MTI, with a 3-day licensing class aimed at Boy Scouts to earn KE5LKJ. A few days after getting his license, Justin talked his father into submitting an application for a vanity call sign with his initials and is now W5JME. That's Whiskey 5, Juliet Mike Echo. Anxious to put his license to use, he checked into his first net the day his license was listed by the FCC and is now a regular on several nets. Justin was recently heard inquiring about what he needs to do to start a kid's net. His mother, Ginger, says that integrating the license study and his developing amateur radio interest into Justin's homeschooling has brought new enthusiasm to his studies. Partly due to Justin's achievements, the Valencia County ARA is working on special youth elmering activities for its younger members and other youth interested in becoming hams. It's a short article, folks, but I'd suggest that if you get a chance, try to listen up for W5JME, Whiskey 5, Juliet Mike Echo, and give Justin a shout and a signal strength report. Let's look through the mailbag and see what we have for the editor. Webpage for Echolink Nets. Thanks to the suggestion of the folks on the Net on 6 meter sideband, which is at 50.135 megahertz net, on Wednesday night at 9 p.m. Eastern Time, I've started a link off my homepage for Echolink Nets. From what I can tell from the Yahoo Group's Echolink server, it has so far been well received. The page, located on the internet at www.wxlder.com/elk.htm, gives a quick overview of Echolink, what's required to use it, a guide to checking into the nets, what's required for a net to be listed on the page, a note about third-party traffic agreements, and the nets by day of the week. Link is also given to a freeware Windows program that will show the time in selected cities and time zones around the world on your Windows desktop. The nets are given in the local day and time for the net. I know that Echolink first started in 2002, but I believe this is the first page of its kind for Echolink nets. Due to antenna and power restrictions at my QTH location, Echolink and VHF packet are the only modes I can work right now. If Echolink helps get more people into the hobby, where we can keep the silent keys from outnumbering the new blood, all the better for amateur radio. And it's signed 73 Daryl Stout, S-T-O-U-T, call N5VLZ, November 5, Victor Lima Zulu, Little Rock, Arkansas. Another letter to the editor, Digital Smidgetal. The state-of-the-art digital modes have become popular with some hams. Personally, I don't care for them for a number of reasons. First, you need a computer and an interface to the radio. The computer program is used to encode and decipher messages. I can understand why the military would have use for a mode that is error-free and secure, but ham radio is a hobby. There is great pleasure in decoding the original digital mode, CW, using one's own onboard computer. I defy anyone to decipher PACTOR, PSK, or the rest without all the required hardware. Another problem is the ability to type faster than 10 or 12 words per minute. I have found that I can operate a Morse paddle at over twice the speed of my typing rate. For those who use the new modes, I only ask that you listen to see if one of us old-timers is on frequency and not transmit close to cause interference. That was submitted by Dick Arnold, Alpha Foxtrot 8X, Dick Arnold, AF8X, and he gives us 73. As I turn the page, I see the name Vegas. That stirs some exciting memories of old. Let's see what it says. It's titled, What Happens in Vegas? They didn't include that next part. Stays in Vegas. I Want a Shout from a Mountaintop. Author David Berry, B-E-R-R-Y, call K-E-4-W. What happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. The popular advertising phrase is likely quite effective in easing the conscience of revelers and attracting even more. My reason for going to Las Vegas, though, does not call for anonymity. I have fun while there. I meet new friends and I wander about for a part of the visit, always amazed at bright lights, spectacular shows, excess and gaudiness. My primary objective on my annual pilgrimage, though, is to share important information with fellow hobbyists and educators. I strive to accomplish two important goals: perpetuating an important and enjoyable hobby, amateur radio, and discussing how to enhance the educational experience for our nation's youth. The occasion for these vital goals is the annual teachers' meeting sponsored by the Radio Club of Junior High School 22, New York City. I'm a guest speaker for the event. The Radio Club of Junior High School 22 is the nation's only full-time nonprofit organization working to get amateur radio into classrooms around the country as a teaching tool using the EDUCOM program. That's spelled E-D-U-C-O-M, EDUCOM program. Now in its 27th year, longtime New York City school teacher Joe Fairclough developed EDUCOM. Education through communication while teaching language arts at PS 22 in Lower Manhattan. Faced with a crisis in the city schools, Joe devised a way to salvage students who were on their last chance. He was able to take a great hobby into the classroom, not as an after-school activity, but as a way to get students interested in learning. The results are remarkable. Lives have been changed. Many times, I heard Joe say, if you get kids interested in learning, they will learn. I'm pleased to be a part of the movement that does just that. Though I am now a college administrator, in 15 years of teaching college, I, too, have used amateur radio in my teaching. My use, though, is insignificant when compared to EDUCOM. Adaptable to any subject, EDUCOM consists of NYC schools-approved curriculum. I had the pleasure to see the curriculum in use in Joe's classroom in Queens, New York in 1995. Having served as a substitute teacher during graduate school, I thought I knew what to expect from a room full of adolescents, what I previously called hormones with feet. I could not have been more wrong. As I engaged several classes that cold January day, they were truly attentive and interested. In fact, they were enthusiastic and interesting. Through EDUCOM, these students became engaged, even eager learners. While I was already a friend and fan of EDUCOM and its developer, that experience was proof of success. I have since heard individual success stories and testimonials from former students. Many point to their EDUCOM experience as among their significant life-changing experiences. Other interested hams and educators need to have the same opportunity. The fifth annual teachers' meeting will be held at the Plaza Hotel in Las Vegas, Nevada, on 07 and 08 July 2007. Meeting attendance is free, and special rates, discounts, and activities have been arranged for attendees, families, and guests. Attendees have the opportunity to network with other teachers and hams, learn how to use radio as a theme to teach a variety of subjects, and improve student success. Complete details are available at the club website, www.wb2jkj.org, or by mail at Radio Club of Junior High School 22, New York City, P.O. Box 1052, New York, New York 10002. Moving now to DX World. For you non-hams, DXing is actually the science or the practice of chasing countries outside of the contiguous United States. Stocking the DXer's software, tool chest. Author Kelly Jones, J-O-N-E-S, call N0VD, November 0, Victor Delta. I received several emails regarding my October 2006 column on using DX clusters. In that column, I mentioned a free program available from Lee Sawkins, S-A-W-K-I-N-S. Lee's call is Victor Echo 7 Charlie Charlie, V-E-7-C-C. A Canadian call. Many of the questions I received were related to other programs that might be helpful in the DXing quest. So I started thinking about it and realized that there is a wealth of software floating around that can really add to the DXer's tool chest, many that I use myself. However, after plunking down your hard-earned money for a new rig, some new antennas, or perhaps a new computer for the shack, your bank account doesn't look as healthy as it once did. No worries. Let's see if we can't stock your tool chest at no additional cost. First, logging programs. There are what I would consider two different types of logging programs: general everyday loggers and contest loggers. If you happen to participate in contests, and you should, as it's a great way to nab some juicy DX, you will want to make sure your everyday logger can import your contest logs. A general type logging program that I personally like and have used for many years is Logger 32, L-O-G-G-E-R, numeral 32, written by Bob Furser, called K4CY. Logger 32 and its predecessor, Logger, has been around for what seems like forever, dating back to the old DOS days. As a general logging program, Logger 32 has about every feature you can imagine, from rig and rotor control to automatically loading your log to Logbook of the World. It will also keep track of your awards, such as DXCC, WAZ, WAS, and many, many more. Now, for the non-ham again, DXCC is the Long Distance Century Club, making at least 100 foreign contacts. WAZ has worked all zones. The whole world is divided into or partitioned by zones. And WAS has worked all states in the United States. The only downside, if you want to call it that, is that Bob has made Logger 32 so user-configurable that it is a bit of a learning curve. However, if you spend a little time with the program, I think you will be well rewarded by its functionality. For an in-depth look at Logger 32, visit the website www.logger32.net/. 32 here is the numerals. Now that you have a general logging program to keep track of your DXCC and other awards, what about those weekends that you go DX hunting during contests? N1MM, that's November 1 Mike, has a fantastic logging program that is geared specifically toward contests where you can easily export files to be used with Logger 32 and many other general loggers. His program is appropriately called N1MM, as are uppercases, November 1, Mike. As this is more of a contest logger than a general logger, you can use N1MM to get involved with the contest, then use it to export your log in both Cabrillo format, used by most contest sponsors, and into ADIF, which is a format most logging programs can import. This allows you to import your weekend contest logs back into your general log and watch your reward totals climb. Details and downloads of N1MM can be found at www.n1mm.com. So what about the QSL labels? QSLs are those little postcards that are so famous around the world that people in amateur radio, exchange with one another to verify that they actually had a contact at a specific time, location, and frequency. Those are the things one needs, QSL cards, to verify participation in contests, etc. So QSL labels. Nearly every logging program can make QSL labels. However, the common problem I have found with the various loggers over the year is that they tend to lack functionality when it comes to printing QSL labels. This has always been a mystery to me, and I suspect one also to Bernd. His first name is B-E-R-N-D, last name K-O-C-K, Bernd Koch. Call is a German call, DF-3, CB, Delta Fox 3, Charlie Bravo, as well. Bernd has written a program that is a label designer's dream called BV7, Travel Victor 7. BV7 lets you completely customize your QSL label in nearly every way conceivable, from printer setup, ability to choose from nearly 1,500 predefined label configurations, number of QSLs per label, and direct printing to QSL cards, just to name a few. BV7 also includes a built-in QSL manager database, which is a great tool for keeping track of stations that change managers. Given the flexibility of being able to import 36 different logbook formats, compatibility with your logging program should not be an issue. You can read more about BV7 by visiting www.df3cb.com/BV1. I'll give that to you phonetically. Delta Foxtrot 3, Charlie Bravo. .com/BravoVictor1. All the programs mentioned in this month's column are available as freeware on the internet. As a software author myself, I can tell you these guys write this stuff for the love of the hobby. If you find you enjoy the software, consider making a small donation to their cause, even if it's just a buck or two. That at least lets them know you appreciate their thankless hard work. I've not even begun to scratch the surface of software available to DXers. I also realize that I have focused on Windows-based programs. There are certainly programs out there for Mac and Linux users. And continuing, DX is. I ran across this one, perfect for reflectors I subscribe to, and thought it really touches the essence of what DX is. The topic of discussion was about bringing new blood, more specifically teenagers, into a hobby and into DXing. Dan Zimmerman's perspective really resonated with me. Dan's call is N30X, November 3, Oscar X-ray. I just stumbled upon amateur radio in 1995 at 15 years old as a result of a thorough geekery and a little bit of CB. DX hooked me. None of my friends got it. You can turn the radio on and let them listen to the beeping of the Donald Duck voices and tell them that they're coming in from faraway place X and they just don't get it. I think it's because DX isn't about distance, but that's all you can really talk about. It's not about contacting foreign nations. You can do that on the internet. DX is about the quality of the band when the K index is zero and it's 4 a.m. and the lake effect snow is howling outside. It's about staring out the window into the darkness as you spin the knob and you're not in the shack. Not really, anyway. You're out there, somewhere, looking for the DX. DX is about the emptiness of a quiet, open band. It's about the potential to trip across a new and faintly beeping a CQ and being the only one up to answer. I get it. Not many people these days do. I think the magic is there, but it's changed and it's more subtle. Instant contact with any point on the globe is routine, but you have to know how to get hold of them. My girlfriend gets it. There used to be a phone booth out in the middle of the Mojave Desert. It was for some mining town. They'd drive 4 or 5 miles out to the booth to use the phone if they needed to. Most of the time it was an empty phone booth in the middle of the desert with no one around for miles. She used to call it and listen to it ring. Put a signal out there. See what happens. Folks, I have sort of condensed part of that article. It's really a very fine article, very lengthy and very detailed in several other aspects as well. It began on page 23 and concludes on page 28 of World Radio, March 2007 issue. Final commentary. That's it for this month's column. I look forward to hearing your comments, complaints, or whatever is on your mind. I'd also like to thank Dan Zimmerman, N30X, for letting me share his thoughtful perspective on what DX is. If you have any DX information you would like announced, please send the information at least 2 months in advance to N0VD, Victor Delta, at dxcentral.com. That's N0VD at dxcentral.com. Until next time, see you in the pileups. And it's signed, N0VD, Kelly Jones. Next interesting category, in the March 2007 World Radio Magazine, VHF FMN repeaters, titled Why the ISS Ham Station Operates Split Frequency. Author Bill Pasternak, WA6ITF. There's been a mounting discussion on many amateur radio internet discussion boards as to why ham radio communications to and from the International Space Station on 2 meters uses split frequency operations. Many of those commenting want manned ham radio space communications to move to single frequency operations so that they are not forced to program in odd offsets to their transceivers. These are mostly newcomers who do not understand the reason for the current ARIS, Amateur Radio International Space Station Operations Plan. So maybe it is time for a bit of a review. The frequencies are the result of years of exhaustive research by the folks who are responsible for any ham radio being in the ISS. The choice was made so that ARIS operations interfere with nobody, and hopefully nobody on the ground interferes with ARIS. Recently, an interesting explanation of the background on manned ham radio operations written by Frank Bauer, KA3HDO. Frank is the ARIS International Chairman and AMSAT VP for Human Spaceflight Programs. Since not all of you are on that mailing list, with the author's blessing, I present an abridged version here. ARIS frequencies. The entire ARISS international team has discussed the frequencies used by manned amateur radio space operations for over 10 years. The MIR, that's MIR, and shuttle teams worked on this for about 13 years before the ARIS team. Collectively, they have spent many hours in international meetings discussing this issue. The ARIS team has developed and implemented an international human spaceflight plan for 2 meters. This plan represents the best compromise that can be developed, given the substantial differences that exist in band planning from one area to the next. Several things to think about. One, we have many astronauts, slant cosmonauts, using the equipment. Two, onboard users of the ARIS equipment do not like to hear the uplink chatter of packet, APRS or SSTV. 3, 1, and 2 above result in the need to separate the uplinks of these non-voice modes from voice. 4, one of the big joys and learning experiences of ARIS is to hear the downlink of the onboard crew member. One cannot do this well when a local ham is transmitting on the same frequency. This is especially true in big cities where there are a lot of hams. I personally experienced the frustration of hams transmitting on the downlink while MIR used simplex. 5. DXers use split mode to prevent this issue so that all can hear the DX station. ARIS is the ultimate DX, so split operation emulates the DX operations done on the ground. 6. Remember, unless the repeater is in use, you cannot hear who is transmitting from the ground when they will stop, so it is generally hard to know when to start. For simplex operations, this results in frequency collisions with people on the ground uplinking at the same time that the onboard crew is downlinking. 7. I am surprised at all the chatter about wanting to get crew members to talk more on the radio. We recently had Bill MacArthur on board, and Pavel is working hard to get SSTV on the air. Kenneth Ransom and Sergei Sambarov have done an outstanding job in getting the onboard crews motivated to use the ham radio systems. I think this community has been around long enough to realize that it is the crew member's prerogative to pick up the mic, simplex or split. 8, constant complaints or slams at the space agencies and other crew members will ultimately limit or eliminate our future operation on ISS and other future vehicles. Remember, many subscribers to these systems are crew members and members of the various space agencies. 9, because of the significant frequency contention on 2 meters, we have developed a dedicated international human space flight frequency segment on 70 centimeters. 10, if we continue to foster a great relationship with the international space agencies, human space flight opportunities beyond low Earth orbit could potentially be in our future. Many of us in the ARIS program are working this very aggressively. These opportunities will dictate the use of much higher bands with smaller antennas and less Doppler. We need to prepare for these opportunities by using some of our higher bands on ISS. It's something to think about for the future. Personally, I really appreciate the constructive feedback from the amateur community. This is how we learn and grow. And while we reminisce about shuttle or Mir, we need to realize that these are the good old days. Let's use them to the best of our ability. With regard to the simplex issue and additional 2-meter frequency, it is my opinion that we have all beaten to death. We have squeezed just about all we can get from 2 meters, and for those in the U.S., please remember that our 2-meter band is 2 times larger than that in many other countries. And thanks again to Frank Bauer, KA3HDO. This completes the piece within the VHF, FM, and repeater part of the magazine reading by Bill Pasternak, WA6ITF, titled Why the ISS Ham Station Operates Split Frequencies. Mr. Pasternak has a few more interesting commentaries. First, New Zealand to Portugal via the moon on 2 meters. Moon bounce enthusiasts in New Zealand and Portugal are claiming a new Earth-Moon-Earth distance record on 06 December 2006 using the digital JT65B mode. Taking part were Nick Wallace, ZL1IU, and Joe Kraft, CT1HZE. Wallace was running 500 watts through 4 12-element Yagis, while Kraft was putting 1.5 kilowatts into 4 11-element beams. The Earth-Moon-Earth contact spanned a terrestrial distance of 19,685 kilometers, supplied by WIA News. And finally, within Mr. Pasternak's materials this month, repeater news. FCC says to clean up repeater to repeater interference. Jeffrey Stouffer of Vista, California, has been told by the FCC to clear up the interference that his uncoordinated K6JSI repeater is causing to coordinated systems. On 01 September 2005, the FCC notified Stouffer that it had received a complaint alleging that he was operating an uncoordinated repeater on 441.650 MHz at Mount St. Helena. Also, his repeater was causing interference to the coordinated KD6FVA repeater at the same frequency. The complaint indicated that Stouffer had been made aware of the interference and the apparent lack of coordination, but that he had declined to resolve the interference. Stouffer responded to the FCC letter on 07 and 17 October 2005, but was unable to show that his repeater is coordinated. As a result, Stouffer was given 20 days from his receipt of the latest FCC communication to detail what steps he is taking to resolve the interference to coordinated repeater KD6FVA. He was also told that the information he submits will be used to determine what further action, if any, the FCC will take in this matter. In cases where two repeaters interfere with one another, the FCC has deemed that the one that's uncoordinated has primary responsibility to clear away any interference it causes to a coordinated machine. That commentary on repeater news was submitted courtesy of the Federal Communications Commission. Well, we're getting close to the witching hour, so I'm going to go to youth form before I run out of airtime here. The Right Frequency. Author Carol with an E, C-A-R-O-L-E, Perry, P-E-R-R-Y, called WB2-M-G-P. As an aside, folks, you wonder why I slowed down on Carol. The spelling, my wife is also Carol with an E, and after 70-some years, she still fights for the right to have the E written down. So there you go, girls. I gave you credit. Hey, hey. In looking through hundreds of my lesson plans to find material to share with others, I smile when I come to the really successful, high motivational sessions that the kids always loved. When you are in the position, as I was for more than 24 years of teaching ham radio as an integral part of the school curriculum, you'll need lots of appropriate supplemental materials. The key to the success of Introduction to Ham Radio, that's the title, was in its appeal to children of different backgrounds and abilities. There were many opportunities for guest speakers, world events, and hands-on demos to add excitement to classroom lessons. But the clever use of one movie in particular always got the desired reaction from the children. When introducing the unit about how natural phenomena affect radio signals, we naturally discussed the Aurora Borealis. In the year 2000, a fabulous movie came out called Frequency. With a PG-13 rating, many of my eighth graders couldn't wait to get to class to tell me how the movie was all about ham radio and time travel. Until my retirement in 2004, selected scenes from this video became a standard enrichment material in my radio classes. Since there never really was a natural light show over Queens, New York, as portrayed in the movie, special effects were used to create images of the Aurora Borealis over Queens. This made it possible for a son to communicate with his dad over a ham radio, even though the dad, played by Dennis Quaid, had been dead for 30 years. They get the chance to go back in time and change events, causing the whole chain of events, including a murder, to be relived as well. In reality, we know that the light show in the sky is actually caused by the sun. The sun is very stormy, constantly sending out solar flares and high-energy charged particles that travel at speeds up to a million miles per hour. Solar wind is made up of streams of these particles. As a strong solar wind gust enters Earth's magnetic field and collides with gases in the upper atmosphere, the gases begin to glow in a variety of colors, shades of green, red, yellow, purple, and blue. The particular color depends on the energy level of each gas particle. When the solar winds ripple the magnetic field, the curtains of light appear to dance, brighten, or fade. One of the most colorful auroras in recent history occurred in March 1989. It was visible in Canada and the United States as far south as Mexico. The electrical surge that accompanied it was so strong that parts of Canada were blacked out all night. Nobody knows exactly why, but according to the Old Farmer's Almanac, the best time to view auroras is during the months around the spring and autumnal equinoxes, on a clear, moonless night, late at night or in the early morning, from around 10 p.m. to about 3 a.m. No two light shows are ever the same, and the most common colors are pink and green. A single active display can produce 1 trillion watts of electricity. All this background information comes to life for the students as they watch the dramatic effect of sunspot activity and the northern lights in a fictionalized story of communications through ham radio across time. The DVD feature section at the end of the movie includes a section on ham radio and a commentary about the writer, producer Toby Emmerich, He explains how he was always fascinated with CB radio and the idea of the possibility of information traveling back through time, but not people. By showing pre-selected scenes from this fascinating movie, Eliminate the Violence, you will be opening the door to scientific discussions for days afterwards. Everyone likes to ponder the what if I could go back in time premise, especially kids. I strongly suggest using frequency to introduce your lessons on radio phenomena. You will all love it. If you use this video or any other that produces good results in a radio class, please be sure to let me know so we can share it. And at the conclusion of the article, the author Carol, with an E, Perry, WB2MGP, can be reached by email at her call sign, which I just gave you, WB2MGP, at ix.netcom.com. Well, folks, we're getting to about the 46-minute mark of our 60-minute presentation for the digest format of World Radio, and we do that with QST Magazine on the Courage Handyham system as well. I'll go to Old Time Radio. The title is Kid on the Wire, Kid on the Wire. David Lohr, L-O-H-R, call. He has two calls here. W0FBI, slant J-E-1, J-K-Y. In 1949, he was a tow-headed, blonde, 12-year-old, an average seventh-grade student living in a very small rural Iowa town. His activities, aside from school, revolved around a daily paper route, occasional summer farm field work, and a winter trap line. A year earlier, he had taken apart an old Atwater Kent radio, harvested one of the ganged variable condensers, and successfully wound, then shellacked the coil on a toilet paper tube. The resulting crystal set with B-29 earphones and 100-foot-long antenna worked well. Nightly, he could hear KDKA, WGM, and WLS, and on Saturday mornings, WHO, Smilin' Ed McConnell and his Buster Brown gang. Then he built a single number 30 tube receiver, which metamorphed rapidly into a regenerative set and finally a two-tube receiver with coils round for the shortwave 75 to 80 meter band. His father, X9 Alpha Echo Foxtrot, had let his license drop after 1925 when he went off to college. He had not forgotten about radio, though, just that being a country doctor and World War II service had interfered a bit. He had been the brains behind the above receivers and was now elmering the kid into learning the international code. The code buzzer, ordered out of Allied Radio Catalog and powered by two telephone dry cell batteries, sat with the J38 key on the dining room table. There it allowed easy access for daily practice, which was monitored by all nearby television sets in the neighborhood, whose owners were puzzled by the strange evening noise. The mystery was solved when Glenn, the town Milwaukee depot agent, came to one of their homes for supper. This resulted in a time of day agreement for code practice and an invitation to visit the depot. The kid was no stranger to the local railroad track connecting Des Moines with Spirit Lake. Walking the tracks about 1 mile north was a good shortcut to the dredge ditch where there were bluegills in the summer, pheasants in the fall, and muskrats in the winter. Years before, he had been fascinated by the loud steam locomotives that daily pulled freight and two passenger trains on the single tracks through his hometown. Frequently, he had them smash pennies flat. He was there so often that occasionally a friend engineer had given him a ride in the cab as they switched grain, lumber, and coal cars on the town's two side tracks. Another elmer of his was Ivan, a friendly depot agent 30 miles down the track, a smooth CW operator who could carry on a conversation and copy background railroad Morse or international code in his head at 30 words a minute. The depot was well known to the kid. It and its detached matching privy where Milwaukee Railroad Greyhounds squatted on a long lawn of dark rust-colored bricks. The yellow-beige small waiting room and row of wall-mounted seats were dwarfed by a pot-bellied coal-fired stove that stood on a thick, square iron floor pad. Once on a cold winter day, he would stop and warm himself by it before starting the last half of the paper route. The clicks and clacks, though, that came from the office area were strange and couldn't be copied. On the day of the invitation, he made his first visit into the depot office, with its projecting West Bay window allowing an easy view up and down the track. This room contained a floor fuel oil stove, a metal box with railroad torpedoes and flares, and an old large heavy floor safe whose door was usually open during the day. On the wall were fuse boxes, electrical switches, a railroad calendar, and the handle to raise and lower the outdoor semaphore that projected above the roof. Up close, he saw the large three-drawer desk with typewriter bug and a stray key bolted to its wooden top. The sounder in its dark, open wooden case was raised a bit above the desktop and was producing a stream of metallic chatter. Stacked trays with white railroad or yellow Western uniforms competed for space with a large, somewhat thin gray rail freight paddock, ashtray, coffee cup, and stapler. A single window with wooden ledge gave simple access to the waiting room for passenger and freight business. Glenn sat at the desk and patiently explained the clicks were dits and the clacks were the da equivalents. In addition, some of the Railroad Morse international code differences were identified and demonstrated on paper, especially letters C, Y, R, and J. After some practice listening that afternoon, the wire became quiet. The git asked if he could call Ivan, whose railroad call was CN. The git's town call was CH. Glenn used the bug and quickly asked on the wire if there was any pending traffic. The sounder remained quiet. Then Glenn sent KID on the wire, or kid on the wire. The kid was nervous, heart pounding and tongue dry, as he hesitantly sat down in the wooden swivel chair before the straight key and slowly sent click, 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 clack, click, three times. Then signed with click, 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 and closed the wire with the key switch. Immediately, he was greeted by the sounder coming to life at three words per minute in International Morse. There followed an exchange of greetings with Ivan, followed by the Perry dispatcher and a half a dozen other depot operators stretched across 90 miles of northwest Iowa. Many were also amateur radio operators, and all enjoyed providing code practice and making a new friend. Over the following 5 years, the kid became a novice, then a general licensed ham operator. He frequently stopped at the depot to chat on the wire with these friends, every one of them an Elmer, though he never met most. The railroad, depots, and wire are now gone, and those Elmers, all silent keys, they've passed on, but the kid has never forgotten the encouragement, patience, and kindness they extended to him as the kid on the wire. This is a true story, 'cause I'm the kid. That was submitted with a very nice photograph of the kid when he was approximately 12, way back, 1949? He's a wee bit older now, folks. Today happens to be, I think, March the 6th, 2007. It was signed David C. Lohr, L-O-H-R, W0FBI/JE1JKY, 78th Signal Battalion, Box 1096, APO, AP 96338. His email is lohr@zma.attmil.ne.jp. What say we finish up with a few bits and pieces of news? 2007 International Deacons Convention, April 7 in California. The 2007 International Deacons Convention will take place 27 April at the Holiday Inn Hotel and Conference Center, Visalia, California. The convention theme this year is Elmering New DXers is Job Number One. A portion of the programming will be devoted to helping new DXers learn about how to be noticed in a pileup, snag a new one, and get that elusive QSL card. Current information and registration forms are available on the convention webpage at www.dxconvention.org, or you can contact Dick Lettrich, L-E-T-R-I-C-H, Convention Registration Chairman, at www.dlw6km@aol.com. Submitted by AR Newsline. Colorado Western Washington ARIS volunteers respond to weather emergencies. Recent weather emergencies in western Washington state resulted in several call-outs of amateur radio communications volunteers. ARIS and RACIS teams across western Washington activated 14 December 06 after severe weather struck the Pacific Northwest. 8 people died and nearly 1.5 million homes and businesses lost electrical power in the wake of the strong winds and heavy rainfall. ARIS volunteers activated in Colorado after the first of two blizzards struck 20 December 06. The initial storm paralyzed a large part of the state and stranded thousands of travelers. The second severe weather system hit about a week later. Governor Bill Owens declared a state of emergency and activated the Colorado National Guard to assist in rescuing stranded motorists. The airport closed again after the second storm arrived. Colorado Section Emergency Coordinator Ben Baker, KB0UBZ, says that amateur radio operators supported the Red Cross and the Salvation Army. Some staffed shelters, while other ARIS members used their four-wheel drive vehicles to transport essential and emergency personnel to their assignments. In both Colorado and Washington, hams in the affected areas proved themselves ready for whatever emergency might come their way. Submitted by Newsline as well. Maybe time for one more little tidbit. The Five Star DXers Association. The Five Star DXers Association has released details about its planned 3 Bravo 7 Charlie 3B7C trip to St. Brendan in 2007. The plan is to take to the air with 12 stations from 07 through 24 September 2007. Neville Sheedle, C-H-E-A-D-L-E, called G3NUG, an English call, and Don Beatty, G3BJ, will jointly lead the expedition. They hope to make more than 100,000 QSOs while activating this much-wanted entity. You can find out more about the expedition and its progress on the web at www.3b7c.com. And finally, a farewell tribute to Alan Call, K-A-U-L, Call W6RCL. A final tribute goes to Alan Call, Silent Key, who helped make amateur radio Newsline and all of amateur radio what it is today. Alan died 22 December 06 at the USC Norris Cancer Center in Los Angeles, California. Alan started with AR Newsline in 1977. His passion was telling stories. He did that both on the job as a West Coast producer for NBC Nightly News and amateur radio. Alan helped bring some of the biggest stories to American television viewers, as well as to the world of amateur radio. Ladies and gentlemen, this brings us up to time for this month's reading of World Radio Magazine in digest form. We've been reading the March 2007 issue. World Radio is published by Armand Noble. His call is N6WR. The editor is Nancy Cott, WZHC. Their location is at 2120 28th Street, Sacramento, California, 95818. And if you choose to call them, they do have an 800 number. It's 1-877-472-8255. 8643. This recording is a production of the Courage Handy Hemp System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, 55422. It is for the use of eligible Handy Hemp members only. Any other use may violate copyright laws. Handy Hems may be reached at area 763-520-0512 or at email address handyhem@